Shake that booty. Peace.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yaggy yak.
Don't go back.
Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom.
Honey, did you know the Rolif Jansen Community Library serves Ankrum, Copake, and Hillsdale?
As a matter of fact, I did know that. Ask me another.
Did you know that the Rojan Library has thousands of books, audiobooks, DVDs, and music CDs you can enjoy for free?
Yep, I knew that too.
Did you know that the Rojan Library puts on dozens of special programs like concerts and lectures, story time for kids, and seminars on computer skills and estate planning?
Uh-huh.
Well, Smarty Pants, is there anything about the Rojan Library you don't know?
Yeah, how do they get all that great stuff done with just 3 employees?
It's all about the volunteers. The library depends on volunteers for everything from working the circulation desk to staffing special events. They can always use more help.
Sounds like fun. How can I become a volunteer?
Just go to the library's website at rojanlibrary.org and click on the volunteer tab.
Hey, I knew that.
Sure you did.
All right, all right. ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to your host, me, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night, Norman. It is the 19th day of June in the year 2023. And I believe it is also the second federal black holiday. I was going to say Negro, but just because it was on my birth certificate, but I'm not going to say it. Anyways, it's Juneteenth. That was when... George Washington crossed the Delaware. I mean, when the Haymarket riots for the 8-hour day happened in Chicago. I mean, it's when the Texans decided that they got the news that the Confederacy was no more. And they had to let my people go. It was a fight, though. I didn't want to let my people go. They were good, cheap labor. as they are today. Okay, I'm not really going to editorialize. This is also the new moon. It is very close to the solstice, if not the solstice, where the hours of the day and the hours of the night equal one another. So in honor of that and many other things, I'm going to read a couple of tales from Lydia Cabrera's Afro-Cuban Tales. This English translation is from 2004 on the University of Nebraska Press. And Cabrera, I think she published this around 1930. Anyways, Cabrera, Lydia Cabrera. Or you can look it up on Wikipedia. You know, do that. The first story is called The Letter of Emancipation. In honor of, she didn't write this in honor of Juneteenth, but I'm going to read it in honor of. I would also like to add, I am going to editorialize, that I live in the city of Hudson, New York, where the first Negro federal holiday, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, which is celebrated in January on the Monday close to Martin Luther King Jr.'s actual birthday, the 15th of January. I would like to say that in this city of Hudson, population somewhere around 6,000 or 7,000, actually has a upstate New York, Columbia County, actually has a substantial population of people of color from throughout the colored diaspora, including Bengalis, Jamaicans, and good old African Americans. And on that federal holiday, there are parking meters in this town. You will be ticketed if you do not put a quarter in the meter on a federal holiday. Banks are closed, schools are closed, federal offices are closed, but they hire two officers of the law to go around and hand out parking tickets on a federal holiday. These gentlemen are probably being paid holiday pay because it's a federal holiday to hand out tickets to people on a federal holiday that celebrates a man who happened to be brown-skinned. Now, of course, they don't ticket vehicles for failure to pay a parking meter on Labor Day or Memorial Day or the 4th of July or even Columbus Day, which some people now call Indigenous Peoples Day or Turtle Island Day or whatever they want to call it. But so it remains to be seen whether or not this second Negro federal holiday will be similarly disrespected by the Parking Bureau of Hudson. I'm not going to say the police or talk about any politicians, but certainly by whoever is running the Parking Bureau. I guess you can find that out online too. Anyways, if you park at a meter in the city of Hudson, New York, on a Negro federal holiday, you will be ticketed for not putting a quarter in the meter. So, if you live around here, say something to one of those political types. I don't really talk to them much. But I bet at all. In fact, I don't. But that being said, I'm going to read Lydia Cabrera's The Letter of Emancipation. Back in the days when animals could speak, when they were all good friends, and when men and animals got along fine, the dog was a slave. And even then he loved men more than anything else. And those days when hours were long and when nobody was ever in a hurry, the cat, the dog, and the mouse were inseparable. As pals in Cuba, they would get together near the port in the courtyard of a grand house whose stained glass windows caught the dying reflections of the sea. There, at the foot of a laurel tree that had been beaten down with all its birds by the new times, they would often spend half the night talking. Once, after Brother Cat and Brother Mouse, who was well acquainted with books and was quite erudite, had sung Liberty's praises and spoken extensively once after Brother Cat and Brother Mouse, who was well acquainted with books and was quite erudite, had sung Liberty's praises and spoken extensively on the rights of all the earth's children, including the children of the sky and the air, Dog realized that he was a slave, and that made him sad. The next day, he went up to see Olufi to ask for a letter granting him his freedom. Baradide Odidena. Wake up, old man, wake up. The oldest man of the heavens scratched his head, thought for a while, wondering if he should grant the request or not. Finally, after shrugging his shoulders and spitting a stream of tobacco juice, as he usually does when making a decision, he scratched his name on a sheet of parchment and gave Dog a proper letter of emancipation. That same evening, Dog was showing it proudly to his friend. Take good care of it, my friend, advised Cat as he was leaving. Now, since Dog didn't have any pockets, he thought the safest place would be to shove it up his ass. But after an hour or so, the rolled-up parchment began to itch. Something awful. More and more uncomfortable, Brother Dog had to walk stiffly, his hind legs spread apart awkwardly. He didn't dare make the slightest movement or express any feelings with his tail. The horrible itching flared up at the most awkward moments, and he couldn't stop himself from running off in desperation to rub his bottom on the ground, not thinking of the consequences. All these humiliating actions happened right in public, and everyone made fun of him. What torture. And on top of everything, he worried constantly about losing the document, or by not being careful enough about making the document illegible and therefore null and void. Brother Dog abstained from eating, but finally, unable to choose between freedom and his incessant suffering, he pulled the document from its hiding place and gave it to his friend, Brother Cat, for safekeeping. Now the cat realized how serious a responsibility it was to leave a manumission letter on a roof where it could be damaged by wind and rain, and he took it to Brother Mouse, who who had a solid house with a good roof on it, but Mouse had gone to the market to get some cheese, and it was Mrs. Mouse who greeted him. So he entrusted the letter to her with all sorts of instructions, but wouldn't you know it, Mrs. Mouse was going into labor. She took that letter in her teeth and ripped it into tiny pieces to line her nest. Meanwhile, Dog had a quarrel with his master. "Give me another bone," he said. And the master replied, "I don't feel like it." Dog stared at the man, who was stepping forward with his whip raised. "I need a lot more to eat because I'm free." But the man said, "You'll eat what I want you to eat. You're born a slave, and you're my slave." "No, sir," shouted Dog, and his tail wagged. "I am not your slave. I have a letter of manumission." "Well, bring it to me, and be quick about it." Dog ran to the courtyard under the laurel tree and called his friend Cat. "Brother Cat, quick, give me my letter of freedom." Cat called Mouse. "Brother Mouse, quick, quick, bring me Dog's letter that your wife is keeping safe." Brother Mouse ran home. His wife was sleeping with seven newborn little mice amidst the torn scraps of paper. He hurried back all embarrassed and whispered into Brother Cat's ear. Then Brother Cat lifted his two front paws and for the first time he extended his claws and pounced on Mouse. Then, for the first time, Dog leaped on Cat and planted his canines in Cat's neck. Lying on his back, Brother Cat struggled valiantly, a veritable whirlwind of meows, slashing claws and teeth, eyes spitting fire and dripping blood. Tiny Brother Mouse scurried off at some point. So, Cat was in a sorry state. And with his fur all ruffled, he climbed up the laurel tree, then out onto the roof. From there, he arched his back and went on meowing and spitting forth his bile and insults at the dog. Then Brother Dog quietly returned, licked his master's hands, and lay down at his feet without saying another word. Like I said, that was the letter of emancipation by Lydia Cabrera. She was the first woman to publish in Cuba, back before it was a commie country. So nobody get mad. I'm not reading stories by communists here. Where is this thing? Okay, I'm going to read another story by Lydia Cabrera from the book Afro-Cuban Tales. It's called Los Compadres. But Lydia Cabrera was born on the 20th of May in 1899 and died on the 19th of September in 1991. She was born in Havana, Cuba, died in Miami, Florida. And this this book, I believe, like I said, yeah, it came out around late 1930s. Yeah, 1937. Anyways, I just thought I would let you know that. Well, I can't find the table of contents here. something more annoying. Oh, there it is. Okay. Los Compadres. Oh, yeah, also this book is translated, obviously, from Spanish. Well, not obviously. I guess she could be Cuban and be bilingual, or even trilingual, or multilingual. But this book was translated from the Spanish into the English by Alberto Hernández Chiroldes and Lauren Joder. I'm not going to say Joder like I'm tempted to, but anyways, this is called Los Compadres. All of us are children of saints, and all of our meanness and the pleasure we take in sinning comes directly from the saints. Following some run-ins with women, the most saintly saint of all had to flee Tacua country and ended up in the Otun region. Django was his name, or Santa Barbara, who also goes by Oacoso, Olafi, Agadgu, Dada, Obaye, and Lubeo. Lubeo being his given name. A real Romeo, he was always itching to pick a fight and was the life of the party. The king of the earth, a braggart, but courageous nonetheless. Quite a handsome fellow, even if he was raised in the gutters. Wherever he was, along with his miracles, he would get himself into all sorts of trouble and have to race out of town. He spent his life running from town to town because many wanted to kill him, but he always got away. In Oshun's country, Nukumi country, he fell in love with Oshun. The Virgin of Charity. He made this conquest while dancing. She said yes immediately, and they began living together. Then one day, Ochun spoke to her older sister, Yemanya, Our Lady of Regla, and said, "If you could see the black fellow I have, you'd be crazy jealous." "What fellow?" Yemanya asked. Django was always with an old man, shadow of his shadow who looked after him, and the old man had already said to Yemanya, "When you meet Django, call him Lubeo. He is your son." Yemanya insisted on seeing Django, and Django seduced Yemanya, and Yemanya was pleased to be seduced. But just as they were about to make love, Yemanya suddenly remembered and shouted out, "Lubeo, you are my son." So she gave him milk from her breast. This news shocked Oshun so much that her head almost fell off. She grabbed it and put it back in place, saying,
"My nephew?
She was my nephew?" "Yes, but it was too late. There was nothing to be done." Dole wasn't really a bad girl. She was Oshun's daughter. She wasn't allowed to eat squash, partly because squash contains Oshun's secret, but mostly because of what had happened in the well. And here's what had happened. Yemanya, while she was Orula's wife, didn't trust Oshun. Orula lived in a well, and Oshun would slip down into it. Yemanya started spying, and she saw Oshun sneaking down into the well. Quietly, she tiptoed off to find the supreme being under his shelter. "Baba Mi, come and see something, Baba Mi." The supreme being who rules over all of them, Chola and Orichaoko and Olua, Oja, Oloku, Ogba, Ogun, Oshozi, Babaluaye, Obaode, Sodgi, Nanu, Nana Buruku, Obatala, as well as the Ibeyes and the Alebas. Babami is older than time, and he has more power than everyone else, just as Shango has more power than all the saints. Yamanya leans out over the well, tugging at Babami's sleeve. Papa, Kwanchaka okoko gonkon uko. And she points her finger to show the Supreme Being what Oshun and Oura are doing in their secret hiding place. Very well, then, said the Everlasting Father. Let St. Francis stay forever with charity. And so, Oura stays with Oshun. Dole wasn't evil, but she wasn't very faithful either. All the men lusted after her, but the man who pleased her the least was her husband, a freed slave who rolled cigars for a living. He had lived most of his life in the country and wasn't as cunning as the city blacks. Dole's lover was with her in the bedroom when her husband came in unexpectedly from the street. She hid the man under the bed, then went and opened the door with her hair messed up, looking distraught and tearful.
Oh, how it hurts. Oh, my stomach. Oh, Evaristo, if you don't want to get some cure from the doctor priest, I'm done for. Evaristo, I'll breathe my last gasp, I swear.
Then she threw herself onto the bed, writhing in pain, biting the pillow. Your stomach hurts? What are you talking about? What cure? What doctor? Wondered Evaristo. Evaristo de la Torre de Cienfuegos was his true illustrious name. Dole, in spite of her pain, explained as best she could how that morning, when he'd gone off to work and she'd begun to do the housework, she had felt a stabbing pain high in her stomach. Pain was so intense that after it had subsided a little, she had gone to see the local brujo. He had questioned her and then told her on behalf of Oya that it was serious. There was some animal in her stomach, a twisted, hairy monster, toad, spider, sponge, or crab with teeth as sharp as pins. She could get rid of it only by eating a fresh alligator egg. There was nothing but an alligator egg that could calm the ravenous hunger of that vicious beast, which otherwise would finish her off by chewing her entrails.
It really hurts. The creature is tearing into me with his teeth. Do you realize, Evaristo, what is happening in my guts?
Poor Evaristo was a good fellow. He dearly loved his little wife, so he was filled with pity at the thought of her guts being eaten up. So he rushed off to the river to find an alligator egg. Then, Dole's lover could come back out. He was all sweaty and bruised, and they had a good laugh at the expense of the poor idiot who might even get swallowed by an alligator. Saula bombo, saula bombo, deal, saula bombo, saula. The idiot is gone. The female alligator had laid 4 eggs. Oh, shit. I just stopped. Okay. All right. The female alligator had laid 4 eggs, but she had posted a guard to watch them, and she herself never strayed far when looking for food. Whenever she heard the slightest noise, a dislodged pebble, some rustling in the reeds, a step, she would rush to the defense of her eggs. Evaristo had to run for his life. He went back many times to the river to try to steal the alligator's eggs. And Dole, having nothing to fear, giggled and dallied with her dearest. Saula Bombo, Saula Bombo leave, Saula Bombo, Saula. The idiot left. Right across from their house lived Evaristo's compadre, Capinche the stevedore. He lived with an attractive washerwoman who was also a santera, and it was said that when she went into her trance, she would eat fire, just like Yansa. Evaristo had been the godfather of a little girl that Capinche had had with another woman, Maria Virtudes. In the evening, they would go to the general store to play dominoes. In earlier days, they had cut a lot of cane together. Now, they were both free. Evaristo rolled cigars at the factory, and Capinche carried loads on the wharves, and had slowly become knock-kneed. Capinche had trouble swallowing the story about alligator eggs and about painful gnawings in her stomach because he and his washerwoman had seen the other fellow come and go many times, and not just when Evaristo went to the river. "Well then, no egg?" asked Dole feebly when her husband returned, panting, his pants dripping with mud and his hands empty.
"Any closer and that alligator would have had me by the foot.
Oh, dear God, mother, now I'll never get well," moaned Dole. "Though I'm feeling a little better now. Perhaps the critter is taking a nap. It's not chewing at me anymore." The animal indeed seemed to be sleeping and wasn't hurting her now. He was sleeping like a baby. Dole could get up, move around. She could work as if she were in perfect health. One day, Evaristo's compadre had drunk a little too much and said to him, "Man, you sure are an idiot, old buddy. A first-class idiot. No offense intended. Your woman has nothing wrong with her stomach. What she has on her mind is fooling around. And when she gets those feelings, there's a big black stud hidden under the bed who gobbles up your goodies while you is out beating your brains working." Evaristo gave no answer. He gritted his teeth, and without even saying goodbye, he went home. Dole was already half asleep. Evaristo maybe felt like strangling her, but he wasn't a hothead. To be sure, he had killed a saltwater Negro several years earlier, a Nyani Go fellow named Rufino, but he had done it by accident, had simply hit him too hard. And nobody had ever found out. Also, one time he had stabbed a fellow during a hot argument at carnival time, but only because the dance and the cheap alcohol had excited him, not at all because he meant evil. Nobody had suspected anything that time either. People don't think you're a bad guy. You're a good guy. I guess I should read for this page. And throughout the book, there are various footnotes for the translations. So for those of you who were freaked out by the term Big Black Stud, it's a translation of the Spanish text, which says Un Negro Chevere. Which is kind of Big Black Stud, but probably in today's parlance, it would be that hot black guy. The Saltwater Negro is a translation of the Spanish text, Un Congo. The word Nyanigo can refer to a special secret language spoken by members of all male, basically, voodoo associations known as Abacuas, and presumably to those who are members of those associations. It also refers to ancestral spirits. And finally, cheap alcohol. follows the translation of malafo, which is in particular sugar cane, grain alcohol. What do you call that stuff? Everclear. The word is probably, I think they call it aguardiente in Mexico. The word is probably African in origin, malafo. In Kikongo and other Bantu languages, the generic term for liquor or wine is malafu. So there's a lot of, I'm not going to read all the footnotes here, but there's a lot of them that deal with the translation. So anyways, when people don't think you're a bad guy, you're a good guy. He tore off his coat and pants, making a real mess of the room. His shoes crashed against the wall, and in his choked up voice, he said to Dole, "Where is that nasty critter? Where is it?" "Shh," she answered as she woke up. Evaristo looked under the bed. He opened the armoire. Compadre Capinche must just be drunk. It was Saturday after all. Just the thoughts of a drunk, and maybe just some mean gossip, and from a good friend too. He himself had never seen anyone sneaking around his house, so now he was scared that Dole's critter might wake up again with its craving for an egg. He pulled a sheet up over his head, leaving his feet sticking out, even though it's not wise to let your bare feet stick out from under the sheet because errant souls from purgatory could come and grab them with their cold hands. Then he fell asleep, snoring away, as he did every night. A few days later, Dole's pain came back, worse than ever. This time, the same animal itself was shouting, welling up in the woman's throat, scolding the poor husband directly.
"Come on, you jerk. You coward. Go get me an alligator egg. I'm tired of..."
Excuse me.
I'm tired of waiting. Otherwise, I'll gobble her up, and it'll be your fault. Then I'll get inside you, too, and eat you up as well."
This made a real impression on Evaristo, and he set out at once, swearing that even if it meant leaving half his body in the river, he'd come back with a cure. As he was rounding a street corner, he had a worrisome thought. The truth comes out of the mouths of drunks and children. Now, my friend was totally drunk. He's right. With that, he stopped short, wondering what to do. A neighbor woman opened her shutters and shouted out to him in mockery.
"Looking for another alligator egg, my dear man?"
"May God protect you, old boy," said the Galician shopkeeper who was playing dominoes at his counter with his black clients. He stood there in his shirt sleeves, his open shirt showing his white haired chest. As he served the mulatto woman a few cents worth of wine in an old olive can, he laughingly whispers something to her through his Spanish-style upturned mustache. She looks Evaristo up and down and then twists her mouth in sympathy. Evaristo then runs into Mateo, the chicken man.
"Chickens! Fat chickens! Cheap!"
"Good morning, Mateo."
"Hey, have you already stolen an egg from Mama Alligator?"
asked Mateo with obvious delight. Everyone is watching, making fun of him.
"You're a first-class idiot," repeats his friend, now no longer drunk, but perfectly clear-headed.
Evaristo goes back home, smashes the door down with one blow, and sure enough, there's Dole being all lovey-dovey and familiar with some man. What really makes Evaristo angry, and rightly so, the pillow's clothes on the coat hook while he's lying in his bare while the man is lying in his very bed in the hollow his very own body had formed in the mattress. By God, the man's head is on his very own pillow. He grabs the first thing he can find, a bottle, and breaks it over the intruder's head. Then he falls upon him like a crazed animal, biting him, kicking him, even butting him with his head.
But we weren't doing anything bad, swore Dole brazenly. We were just chatting. He's one of my country cousins, and he was so tired.
The fellow managed to escape into the street, stark naked. Some women screeched.
Catch him! Catch him!
The Galician shopkeeper grabbed him for Evaristo with the aid of two other neighbors and the chicken man, who was still holding a cluster of lively chickens in his right hand, and the man with his left. The whole neighborhood knew that something like this would happen sooner or later. Nobody was surprised by the turn of events.
Police! Police! Nobody move!
The civil guard had caught a whiff of something. The fellow standing with no shirt on his back, Dole gesticulating and rambling on, unable to stop, the crowd of curious onlookers, all got quiet while they waited expectantly.
A simple argument, Mr. Law and Order. Yes, that's all. But now it's over. Nothing at all happened.
The policemen brandished their sticks impressively. They scowled through their black, bushy eyebrows. One had no space at all between his eyebrows. And there they stood, symbols of justice, right there on the sidewalk, leaning against one of those big bay windows low to the ground. They stood there twisting their mustaches menacingly, for they always have it in for black people. And all the commotion, the mulatto customer's wine had splashed out on the ground. She walked off, lugging her empty can, mumbling to herself about wasting all that good wine. A few of the women hurried over to Dole to give her some herbal tea. Evaristo couldn't bear to raise his head. They had made a fool of him. His friend slapped him on the back to make him feel better. Oh, man, if only the police hadn't shown up, that jerk wouldn't have been long for this world. Finally, the policemen move off, prancing haughtily in their boots. That evening, the whole neighborhood shows up at Evaristo's house in case he should try to do something stupid. It's as if there's a party at his house, or a wake, which is about the same thing. Even passing strangers give their opinion when they stop to look in through the open door and are told the details of the situation. Each neighbor brings something to help pass the time at the wake. A chunk of cheese, guava paste, some crackers, coffee, a tin of sardines, beer, cheap alcohol. We certainly better not leave Evaristo and Dole alone just now. Don't do anything you'll regret, advises the Santera laundry woman. Surrounded by his male friends, there's Evaristo, seated on a trunk, side saddle. He's still furious and doggedly keeps muttering the same obscenity. Dole, sitting in an armchair, still only partially clothed, sighs again and again. Her voice is broken by sobs. She raises her arms and lets them drop. Her head is aching, she says.
My skull, it's exploding.
The women standing near her take turns fanning her. But there's no way to loosen the iron band she feels around her neck. They put more herb tea on the stove to boil. Finally, Evaristo's compadre arrives. His best friend, Capinche, whom everyone has been waiting for. He goes straight to the heart of things with all the authority that being Evaristo's compadre gives him. Evaristo, what's this I hear? We must set an example of good upbringing. Everything's over. For us, it's ancient history. And indeed, you've acted like a true gentleman. No, Evaristo answers. It's not over. Dole should never have done what she did to me without my consent.
Oh, my dear man, exclaims Dole, weeping hot tears. If you want me to go away, I'll be off. But I'd rather you killed me, my love, my angel, because you are the man I love, my treasure. My dear, you're the man I love.
Sure. Well, if I ever find you in bed again with someone else, I'll smash you in the baby poop. I will.
Never again, Evaristo.
Capiche got permission from the authorities to organize some drumming. So some drummer friends of the couple showed up, plus Dole's goddaughter, who was 6 months pregnant, and who had hurried over when she heard what was happening. Evaristo's anger slowly faded away. By 3 a.m, everyone was dancing. From the back room of his store, the Galician shopkeeper could hear the drum booming. With all the bursts of laughter and the noise that his black neighbors were making, plus the heat, the mosquitoes, and the bedbugs that had faithfully followed him from Spain, he couldn't get to sleep. Oh, brother, los negros. They think that dancing can take care of everything. They dance when they're born, they dance when they die, they dance for killings. They have to celebrate everything. Even the horns, their wives, make them grow. The black Santera washerwoman who lived with Capinche died from a bad cold, or more likely from a certain procedure that the Mayombero did for her. Nobody dies a natural death, and she had some enemies among those with magical powers. Some were powerful enemies. When she was told that somebody had heard her name spoken over the cauldron, the spell was already pretty far along, and the talisman made to protect her didn't do any good at all. Somebody had worked too fast. That's what black magic is, continuous, hidden warfare. A nail can protect you from another nail, but if a spell is cast properly by a sorcerer who knows his stuff, it is very difficult to escape. So the poor woman said as she died, not even Santa Barbara is of any help to me now. Certainly not my new talisman. So she left this world, leaving Capinche, a little black 3-year-old with crooked legs like him, whom Dole and Evaristo carried to be baptized. And since Evaristo was the boy's godfather, he and Capinche were doubly linked by the sacraments and doubly compadres. The little fellow grew up in Dole's house, and Capinche would spend his free moments in his friend's quarters. Dole had a sewing machine now. Tobacco had finally gotten to Evaristo's lungs, and he would often wake up coughing blood. So on such days, it felt like he hadn't had a drop of blood left in his veins, and he couldn't go to work. Dole had become a seamstress to help him earn some money, for she wasn't a bad sort at all. She had a big heart. The saints, according to the consultation that was arranged for Evaristo, kept asking for goats, pigeons, roosters to be sacrificed, and ordered him to eat a lot of raw meat and to drink lots of eggnog. The pharmacist tried to heal him with a very expensive French prescription. One centaine, that's what the medicine cost, and it wouldn't last any time at all. Capinche also contributed to the household budget. He gave everything he made, absolutely everything. So thanks to him, his compadre could afford the patent medicine. But Capinche no longer had a woman in his own house and went out with a different woman every night. And sometimes he didn't have any woman at all. He began to be taken with Dole, and then he fell in love for good. One day he didn't leave for work at the docks. She was alone, working at her sewing machine, and Capinche sat down beside her. He watched her silently, his nostrils dilating. Suddenly, he grabbed her in his arms, saying, mi comadre, how I love her. Let's go make love, my girl. Dole pushed him away and crossed herself. To tell the truth, she didn't find him unappealing, and indeed she might really have enjoyed. But what about the sacrament of baptism? The sacrament! So there the two stood, trembling, with embarrassment. Embarrassment. Ah, Dole, Dole, why the sacrament? God only knows.
Now, a pig, before being a pig, looked very much like a man. It was a man. He offended his mother, and she put a curse on him. So he became a pig with 4 feet, a fat tummy, a snout for digging, and a corkscrew tail. But inside, he is just like a man. A compadre who betrays his compadre after they've been tied together by the body of Christ risks uncounted calamities. The punishment is horrible. A woman who conducts herself badly with her comadre, or with her compadre, which would be the same thing, is digging her own grave. She can even picture the worms eating her. Her soul would need masses fed for centuries. That's what happened to Cecilia Alvarado from Arroyo Naranjo. She lay in agony, fully conscious for 22 days because she had betrayed her comadre. She had spent money her comadre had entrusted to her and then had said horrible things about her to justify herself. The family council gathered and agreed to persuade the offended woman to forgive her. In spite of what she knew, she did forgive her. And the poor woman could finally turn toward the wall and die in peace. But if she hadn't been pardoned, what would have awaited her under the earth? So you can't take sacraments or the saints lightly. One of Evaristo's friends had been run over by a cart full of mangoes. And why? Because he had promised he would build an altar to San Lazaro, to Babalu Aye, if he won the lottery. He won a lot of money. Rented a fruit shop, bought himself a horse and a cart, and spent the rest having a good time, completely forgetting his promise to build the altar to San Lazaro. Then San Lazaro, through a shell reading, had a message sent to him. How about my altar? Do you think I'm a kid playing me for a fool like that? If you don't take care of what you promised me, get ready to die a horrible death. But the man acted like a smarty pants. And he answered lightly, "Ah, the old fellow can wait. He's in no hurry." Well, one day when he was walking along, he was run over by another fruit merchant's cart. Nobody knows just how. How unfortunate to be compadres linked by the sacraments. How vexing for Dole and Capinche. They were in love, but they didn't dare act. Capinche would show up at times when Evarista wasn't around. Ah, my comadre, how I love her. Let's go make love, my comadre. Such was his refrain, and it was tough for Dole to resist. But fear was stronger, and she couldn't forget the sacrament. Capinche would lower his eyes, bite his lips until they bled, and walk off, cursing under his breath. One day, while she was struggling to get loose from Capinche's grasp, he said to her, "Evaristo is thin as a rail. You can see death in his face." "When he's dead, Capinche, then yes," she answered. "Wait until he's dead." Capinche thought, "Since my pal is about to die, it wouldn't matter if he died a little early. He wouldn't suffer as long." Poor Evaristo soon was barely able to sit up in bed without help. Nonetheless, his eyes would brighten with hope when Dole came back from butcher shop and proudly held up chunks of blood-red meat. But they were too much for him to eat, and when he finally was unable to eat anything at all anymore, he still put his faith in the spoonfuls of the prescription that was surely infallible since it was so expensive. He would ask for some of it at all hours of the day and painfully swallow it with fervor. But there came a day when there was no money to buy it with, and Capinche, instead of giving him some of the saving syrup of liquid gold, suggested giving him a special herb brew made by a black santero. As evening fell, the poor fellow began to gasp for breath. He coughed one last time, a little dry wool-like cough. The sheets felt uncomfortable, and so did his restless hands. He wanted to see light. The great morning light that belongs to healthy men. He spoke of getting up, saying that he would go walking in the country on the sugar mill property where he had been born. There in the slave quarters, he could hear his mother calling him. Why did she want to see him? All his dead relatives were calling him too.
Later he relaxed and dozed off. He must have died like a little bird, for Dole never noticed that he made the slightest sound. She went and lit an oil lamp and came over to give him a cup of milk. Oh, good God, Evaristo is dead. He's gone out like a candle, poor fellow. He didn't want to bother anyone, even to kick the bucket. That's just like him, patient, quiet, calm, even when he dies. Oh, blessed mother, after so much effort, so much stake, so many prayers, so many months on thin prescriptions, when his compadre hears the news. And people went to the docks to tell his compadre the news. Please forgive us for what we have to say, but your compadre is dead. Capinche paid all the funeral costs. What wouldn't one do for a compadre? When you've drunk so many of the good things of life with him, you have to accept the bitter as well. He mourned him with such pain that seeing him like that could have broken anyone's heart. Capinche, man, don't cry. And he wiped his tears with a red kerchief that had belonged to his dead friend. Who would have thought that so quickly, such a fine fellow as Evaristo was, everyone in the neighborhood respected him, never a misplaced word, always ready to lend a hand. They praised his virtues, his good sense, his urbanity, especially his urbanity now that most blacks had become such vulgar riffraff for raising their kids right so they would be respectful. There was nobody like the people who came directly from Africa. Creoles and children of Creoles couldn't be conducting themselves worse. What a difference there was between them and good old African stock, like Evaristo. Dole, in despair, would no sooner finish one crying spell than she would start another. There lay Evaristo between four candles that were also crying. Now people could see how thin he had become. He was nothing but skin and bones. However, how fine he looks, and how lifelike. All the blacks of Congo Real, his cabildo, showed up, circumspect and ceremonious. Others came from Pueblo Nuevo, from Santa Barbara. There were friends from the cigar factory, the stevedores who worked with Capinche, friends of friends, distant acquaintances of the dead man, or of no one in particular. Our hearts are with you. All the neighbors brought their chairs. They sit down, elbow to elbow around the corpse. The kitchen's a mess, but they've set up a camp cot there in case some women collapse during the night and need to lie down. Dole comes into the room unsteadily as if she were walking in her sleep. She wakes up and bursts out, Evaristo, she says to the corpse. Open your eyes, my angel, and look at your Dole, look at your compadre, look at your godson, Jose, look at all your friends who are here. Her voice rises. Oh, my God, why have you taken him from me? My God, this morning you woke up so full of life and so frisky. He wanted to go out walking, and now he can't even speak anymore. He can't, so to say, Dole anymore. Oh, my, why have you left me, my man? He paid for my room, the dear man who loved me. Oh, my dear man who is better than good bread. She embraces the corpse, shaking it like a plum tree. We've got to get her away from the corpse so she can't see it anymore, the poor thing. She's inconsolable. It's as if she's completely crazed, but it ain't surprising. And all the women begin to shout like Dole, each louder than the other. Two or three stiffen and fall heavily to the floor as if on cue. Then they begin to convulse and froth at the mouth. One old man, a saltwater Negro, who was pleased with such an outpouring of grief that made it a good wake, said to Dole, Mwana, we will now pray for the corpse. Let us now, Langaina Angayonso, he died. Let us now, Langaina Angayonso, do you remember? Let us now, Langaina Angayonso, alas, dear God, what pain. Until late in the night, they exchanged stories about wakes. After all, they had to entertain their friends and the dead man until morning. One Creole man told about the wake held for a local black, a pure African, over yonder on a coffee plantation near Pinar del Rio. He was a dark-skinned cowherd who was very old when he died. They wrapped him naked in a sheet and laid him out in a corner of his hut. For candles, they used earthenware bottles.
They painted his face with plaster. By 8 o'clock in the evening, all the black plantation workers had so filled up the hut you couldn't have slipped a needle between